potentially is skill in expressing the unexpressible is superb. Nobody has ever been able to surpass him. He has mapped the inner world of consciousness as accurately as it is possible. Almost he has done the impossible job. I have heard one story about Ramakrishna. One day he said to his disciples, "I will tell you everything today and will not keep anything secret." He described clearly the centers and the corresponding experiences up to the heart and throat, and then pointing to the spot between the eyebrows, he said, "The Supreme Self is directly known and the individual experiences samadhi when the mind comes here." There remains then but a thin transparent screen separating the Supreme Self and the individual self. The sadhaka then experiences. Saying this, the moment he started to describe in detail the realization of Supreme Self, he was plunged in samadhi and became unconscious. When the samadhi came to an end and he came back, he tried again to describe it and was again in samadhi. Again he became unconscious. After repeated attempts, Ramakrishna broke into tears, started crying, and told his disciples that it is impossible to speak about it. But Ramakrishna has tried in many ways, from different directions, and this always happens. His whole life, whenever he will come beyond the third eye center and will be coming nearer Sahasrar, he will be caught hold by something inner so deeply that the very remembrance of it, the very effort to describe it, and he is gone. For hours he will remain unconscious. It's natural, because the bliss of Sahasrara is such, one is almost overpowered by it. The bliss is so oceanic that one is possessed by it and taken over. One is no more oneself once you transcend the third eye. Ramakrishna tried and failed, could not describe it. Many others have not even tried. Lao Tzu, for his whole life, resisted not to say anything about the world of Tao because of this. Nothing can be said about it. And the moment you try to say it, you are plunged into an inner whirlwind, whirlpool. You are lost, drowned. You are bathed in such beauty and beatitude that you cannot utter a single word. But Patanjali has done the impossible. He has described as exactly as possible each step, each integration, each chakra, its functioning, and how to transcend it up to Sahasrara and even beyond he has indicated. On each chakra, on each wheel of energy, a certain integration happens. Let me tell you, at the sex center, the first center, the most primitive, but the most natural, the one that is available to all, the integration happens between the outer and the inner. Of course, it is momentary. A woman meeting a man, or a man meeting a woman, come for a single moment, a split moment, where the outer and inner meet and mingle and merge into each other. That's the beauty of sex, the orgasm, that two energies, the complementary energies, meet and become one whole. But it is going to be momentary, because the meeting is through the most gross element, the body. The body can touch the surfaces, but it cannot really enter into each other. It is like ice cubes. If you put two ice cubes together, they can touch each other. But if they melt and become water, then they meet and mingle with each other. Then they go to the very center. And if the water evaporates, then the meeting becomes very, very deep. Then there is no I, no thou, no inner, no outer. The first center, the sex center, gives you a certain integration. That's why there is so much hankering for sex. It is natural. It is in itself beneficial and good. But if you stop there, then you have stopped in the porch of a palace. The porch is good. It leads you into the palace, but it is not a place to make your abode. It is not a place to stop forever. And the bliss that is waiting for you on higher integrations of other centers will be missed. And in comparison to that bliss and happiness and joy, the beauty of sex is nothing. The pleasure of sex is nothing. It simply gives you a momentary glimpse. The second chakra is the hara. At the hara, life and death meet. If you reach to the second center, you reach to a higher orgasm of integration. Life meeting death. Sun meeting moon. And the meeting is inner now. So the meeting can be more permanent, more stable. Because you are not dependent on anybody else. Now you are meeting your own inner woman or your own inner man. The third center is the navel. There, the positive and the negative meet. The positive electricity and the negative electricity. Their meeting is even higher than life and death, because the electric energy, the prana, the bioplasma, our bioenergy, is deeper than life and death. It exists before life, it exists after death. Life and death exist because of bioenergy. This meeting of bioenergy at the navel nabhi gives you even a higher experience of being one, integrated, a unity. Then is the heart. At the heart center, the lower and the higher meet. At the heart center, the Prakriti and Purusha, the sexual and the spiritual, the worldly and the otherworldly, or you can call it the meeting of heaven and earth. It is still higher, because for the first time, something of the beyond dawns over. You can see the sun rising at the horizon. You are still rooted in the earth, but your branches are spreading into the sky. You have become a meeting. That's why the heart center gives ordinarily available the highest and the most refined experience, the experience of love. The experiences of love is the meeting of earth and heaven. So love is in a way earthly and in another way heavenly. If Jesus defined God as love, this is the reason. Because in human consciousness, love seems to be the highest glimpse. Ordinarily, people never go beyond the heart center. Even to reach at the heart center seems to be difficult, almost impossible. People remain at the sex center. If they are trained deeply in yoga, karate, aikido, tai chi, then they reach to the second center, the hara. If they are trained into deep mechanism of breathing, prana, then they reach navel center. And if they are trained how to look beyond earth and how to see beyond the body and how to look so deeply and so sensitively that you are no more confined with the grass and the subtle can penetrate its first rays into you, then only heart. All paths of devotion, bhakti, yoga, work on the heart center. Tantra starts from the sex center. Tao starts from the hara center. Yoga starts from the navel center. Bhakti yoga, paths of devotion and love, Sufis and others, they start from the heart center. Higher than heart is the throat center. Again, there happens another integration, even more superior, more subtle. This center is the center of receiving and giving. When the child is born, he receives from the throat center. First life enters into him from the throat center. He sucks air, breathes, and then he sucks milk from his mother. The child functions from the throat center, but it is half functioning, and soon the child forgets about it. He just receives. He cannot give yet. His love is passive. And if you are asking for love, then you remain juvenile. You remain childish. Unless you mature that you can give love, you have not become a grown-up. Everybody asks for love, demands love, and almost nobody gives. That's the misery all over the world. And everybody who demands thinks that he is giving, believes that he is giving. I have looked into thousands of people, all hungry for love, thirsty for love, but nobody in any way trying to give. And they all believe that they are giving, but they are not receiving. Once you give, you receive naturally. It has never happened otherwise. The moment you give, love rushes in you. It has nothing to do with persons and people. It has something to do with the cosmic energy of God. The throat center is the meeting of receiving and giving. You receive from it and you give from it. That is the meaning of Christ saying that unless you become a child again. If you translate it into the yoga terminology, it will mean unless you come to the throat center again. The child forgets by and by. If you look into Freudian psychology, you will have a parallel. Freud says the first state of the child is oral. The second stage is anal. And the third stage is genital. The whole Freudian psychology ends with the third. Of course, it is a very poor psychology. Very rudimentary, fragmentary. And concerning with the very lower functioning of human beings. Oral, yes, the child uses the throat center just to receive. And once he has started receiving, his being moves to the anal. Have you watched that few people cling to the oral, even to up to their death? These are the people you will find is smoking. These are oral people. They still go on. The smoke, the cigarette, the cigar gives them a feeling as if something hot like mother's milk is passing through the throat center. And they remain confined to the oral and they cannot give. If a person is a chain smoker, heavy smoker, almost always he is not a giver of love. He demands, but he will not give. People who are too much in smoking are always too much interested in women's breasts. Bound to be. Because a cigarette is a substitute of the nipples. I am not saying that people who are not smokers are not interested in women's breasts. Those who smoke, they are interested. Those who don't smoke, they are also interested. They may be chewing pan or gum or something else. Or they may be simply interested in pornography. Or they may be just obsessed by the breast continuously. In their mind, in their dream, in their imagination, fantasy, the breast. Breasts and breasts go on floating all around them. These are oral people stuck. When Jesus says you have to be child again, he means you have to come back to the throat center, but with a new energy to give. All creative people are givers. They may sing a song for you, or dance a dance, or write a poem, or paint a picture, or tell you a story. For all these, the throat center is again used as a center to give. The meeting happens at the throat of receiving and giving. The capacity to receive and to give is one of the greatest integration. There are people who are only capable of receiving. They will remain miserable. Because you never become rich by receiving, you become rich by giving. In fact, you possess only that which you can give. If you cannot give it, you simply believe that you possess. You don't possess it. You are not a master. If you cannot give your money, then you are not the master of it. Then the money is the master. If you can give it, then certainly you are the master. This will look like a paradox, but let me repeat it. You are the possessor of only that which you give. The moment you give, in that very moment you have become a possessor, enriched. Giving enriches you. Miserly people are the most miserable and poor people in the world. Poorer than the poor. They cannot give. They are stuck. They go on holding. Their holding becomes a burden on their being. It does not free them. In fact, if you have something, you will become freer. But look at the misers. They have much, but they are burdened. They are not free. Even beggars are more free than them. What has happened to them? They have used their throat center just to receive. Not only that, they have not used their throat center to give, they have not even moved to the second Freudian center, anal. These people are always constipatory. Hoarders, misers, always suffer from constipation. Remember, I am not saying that all people who have constipation are misers. There may be other reasons. But misers are certainly constipated. Freud says that there is something in gold and excreta. Both look yellow. And people who are constipatory are too much attracted with gold. Otherwise, gold has no existential value. Some psychological value, but no existential value. You cannot eat it. You cannot drink it. What can you do with it? Even a glass of water is more valuable existentially. But why gold has become so valuable? Why people are so much obsessed with gold? They have not moved from the oral to the anal. They are constipated in their inner being. Now their whole life will reflect their constipation. They will become hoarders of gold. Gold is symbolic. The yellowness gives them some idea. Have you watched small children? It is almost difficult to persuade them to go to the toilet. They have almost to be forced to go to the toilet. And even then they insist that nothing is happening, can I come back? They are learning the first lessons of measureliness. How to hold, how not to give, even that which is useless, even that which is harmful if you keep it within you, even the poison, it is difficult for them to leave it, to renounce it. I have heard about two Buddhist bhikkhus. One of them was a miser and a hoarder, and he used to collect money and keep it, and the other used to laugh at this foolish attitude. Whatsoever will come on his way, he will use it, he will never hoard it. One night they came across a river, and it was evening and the sun was setting, and it was dangerous to stay there. They had to go to the other shore. There was a town. This side was simply wilderness. The hoarder said, "Now you don't have any money, so we cannot pay to the ferryman. What do you say now about it? You are against hoarding. Now if I don't have any money, we both will die. You see the point," he said. "Money is needed." The man who believed in renunciation laughed, but he didn't say anything. Then the hoarder paid, and they crossed the river. They reached to the other shore. The hoarder again said, "Now remember, next time don't start arguing with me. You see, money helps. Without money, you would have been dead. The whole night on the other shore, it was dangerous to survive. Wild animals." The other bhikkhu laughed and he said, "But we have come across the river because you could renounce it. It is not because of hoarding that we have survived. If you had insisted to hoard it and you were not going to pay to the ferryman, we would have died. It is because you could renounce, because you could leave it, you could give it, that's why we have survived." The argument must be continuing still. But remember, I am not against money. I am all for it. But use it. Possess it. Own it. But your ownership arises only the moment you have become capable of giving it. At the throat center, this new synthesis happens. You can accept and you can give. There are people who change from one extreme to another. First they were incapable of giving, they could only receive. Then they change, they go to the other extreme. Now they can give but they cannot receive. That too is lopsidedness. A real man is capable of accepting gifts and giving them back. In India you will find many sannyasins, many so-called mahatmas, who will not touch money. If you give them, they will shrink back, as if you have produced a snake or something poisonous. Their shrinking back shows that now they have moved to the other extreme. Now they have become incapable of receiving. Again their throat center is functioning half. And a center never functions really unless it functions full, unless the wheel moves full way, goes on moving and creates energy fields. Then is the third eye center. At the third eye center, the right and left meet. Pingala and Ira meet and become Susumna. The two hemispheres of brain meet at the third eye. That is just between the two eyes. One eye represents the right, another eye represents the left, and it is just in the middle. These left and right brains meeting at the third eye. This is very high synthesis. People have been capable to describe up to this point. That's why Ramakrishna could describe up to third eye. And when we started to talk about the final, the ultimate synthesis that happens as Sahasrara, he again and again fell into silence, into samadhi. He was drowned in it. It was too much. It was flood-like. He was taken over to the ocean. He could not keep himself conscious, alert. The ultimate synthesis happens at Sahasrara, the crown chakra. Because of this Sahasrara, in all the world, kings, emperors, monarchs and queens use the crown. It has become formal, but basically it was accepted, because unless your Sahasrara is not functioning, how can you be a monarch? How can you be a king? How can you rule people? You have not even become a ruler of yourself. In the symbol of the crown is hidden a secret. The secret is that a person who has reached to the crown center, the ultimate synthesis of his being only, he should be the king or the queen, nobody else. Only he is capable of ruling others, because he has come to rule himself. He has become a master of himself. Now he can be helpful to others also. Really, when you achieve to Sahasrara, a crown flowers within you. A 1,000-petaled lotus opens. No crown can be compared with it. But then it became just a symbol. And the symbol has existed all over the world. That simply shows that everywhere people became alert and aware in one way or other of the ultimate synthesis in the Sahasrara. Jews use the skull cap. It is exactly on the Sahasrara. Hindus allow a bunch of hairs. They call it choti, the peak, to grow exactly on the spot where the Sahasrara is or has to be. There are few Christian societies which save just that part of the head. When a master blesses a disciple, he puts his hand on the Sahasrara. And if the disciple is really receptive, surrendered, he will suddenly feel an upsurge of energy running from the sex center to the Sahasrara. Sometimes when I touch your head and you suddenly become sexual, don't be afraid. Don't shrink back. Because that is how it should be. The energy is at the sex center. It starts uncoiling itself. You become afraid. You shrink. You repress it. What is happening? And becoming sexual at the feet of your master seems to be a little awkward, embarrassing. It is not. Allow it. Let it be. And soon you will see it has passed the first center and the second. And if you are surrendered, within a second, the energy is moving at the sahasrar, and you will have a feeling of a new opening within you. That's why a disciple is supposed to bow down his head so the master can touch the head. The last synthesis is of object and subject, the outer and inner again. In a sexual orgasm, outer and inner meet but momentarily. In sahasra, they meet permanently. That's why I say one has to travel from sex to samadhi. In sex, 99% is sex, 1% is sahasrar. In sahasrar, 99% is sahasrar, 1% is sex. Both are joined. They are bridged by deep currents of energy. So if you have enjoyed sex, don't make your abode there. Sex is just a glimpse of sahasrar. Sahasrar is going to deliver 1,000-folds, 1,000,000-folds, a bliss to you, benediction to you. The outer and the inner meet, I and thou meet, men and women meet, yin and yang meet, and the meeting is absolute. Then there is no parting, then there is no divorce. This is called yoga. Yoga means meeting of the two into one. In Christianity, mystics have called it Unio Mystica. That is exact translation of yoga. Unio Mystica. The mysterious union. At the sahasrar, the Alpha and the Omega meet. The beginning and the end. The beginning is in the sex. Sex is your Alpha. Samadhi is your Omega. And unless Alpha and Omega meet, unless you have attained to this supreme union, you will remain miserable, because your destiny is that. You will remain unfulfilled. You can be fulfilled only at this highest peak of synthesis. Now the sutras. Performing sanyama on their power of cognition, real nature, egoism, all pervasiveness and functions brings mastery over the sense organs. The first thing to be understood is that you have senses, but you have lost sensitivity. Your senses is almost dull, dead. They are there hanging with you, but energy is not flowing in them. They are not alive limbs of your being. Something has deadened within you, has become cold, blocked. It has happened to the whole humanity. Because of thousands of years of repression and thousands of years of conditioning and ideologies which are against the body have crippled you. You live only for name's sake. So the first thing to be done is your senses should become really alive and sensitive. Only then they can be mastered. You see, but you don't see deeply. You see only the surface of things. You touch, but your touch has no warmth. Nothing flows in and out from your touch. You hear also. The birds go on singing and you hear. And you can say, yes, I am hearing. And you are not wrong, you are hearing. But it never reaches to the very core of your being. It does not go dancing within you. It doesn't help a flowering and unfolding within you. These senses have to be again rejuvenated. Yoga is not against the body. Remember, yoga says go beyond the body, but it is not against the body. Yoga says use the body, don't be used by it, but it is not against the body. Yoga says the body is your temple. You are in the body, and the body is so beautiful an organism, so complex and so subtle, so mysterious, and so many dimensions open through it. And those are the only doors and windows you will reach to God through. So don't deaden them. Make them more alive. Let them vibrate, pulsate. And what Stanley Kelman has called, let them stream. That is exactly the right word. Let them flow like a stream, rushing. You can have the sensation, your hand, if it is rushing like a stream of energy, you will feel a tingling sensation. You will feel something inside the hand is flowing and wants to make contact, wants to be connected. When you love a woman or a man and you take her hand in your hand, if your hand is not streaming, this love is not going to be of any use. If your hand is not jumping and throbbing with energy and pouring energy into your woman or into your man, then this love is almost dead from the very beginning. Then this child is not born alive. Then sooner or later you will be finished. You are already finished. It will take a little time to recognize. Because your mind is also dull, otherwise you won't enter into it. Because it is already dead for what you are entering. You take time to recognize things because your sensitivity, brilliance, intelligence is so much clouded and confused. Only a streaming love can become a source of blissfulness, of joy, of delight. But for that you will need senses streaming. Sometimes you have that glimpse also. And everybody had it when he was a child. Watch a child running after a butterfly. He's streaming. As if any moment he can jump out of his body. Watch a child when he is looking at a rose flower. See his eyes, the brilliance, the light that comes to his eyes. He's streaming. His eyes are almost dancing on the petals of the flower. This is the way to be river-like. And only then it is possible to master these senses. In fact, people have been in a very wrong attitude. They think that if you want to master your senses, you have to make them almost dead. But then what is the point of mastery? You can kill, and you are the master. You can sit on the corpse. But what is the point of being a master? But this looked easier. First to kill them, and then you can master. If the body feels too strong, fast, make it weak, and then you start feeling that you are the master. But you have killed the body. Remember, the life has to be master, not dead things. They will not be of any use. But this has been found to be a shortcut. So all the religions of the world has been using it. Destroy your body by and by. Disconnect yourself from the body. Don't be in contact. Remove yourself away. Become indifferent. Then your body is almost a dead tree. No more leaves come to it. No more it flowers. No more birds come to rest. It is just a dead stump. Of course you can master it, but now what you are going to gain from this mastery? This is the problem. That's why people don't understand what Patanjali means. Performing Sanyama on their power of cognition. Your eyes see, your ears hear, your nose smells, your tongue touches, your hands make contact, your feet make connectedness with the earth. That is their power of cognition. Performing Sanyama on their power of cognition, but they have to be powerful. Otherwise you will not be able to even feel what power is. These senses have to be so full of power, so high with power, that you can perform Sanyama, that you can meditate upon them. Right now when you look at a flower, the flower is there, but have you ever felt your eyes? You see the flower, but have you felt the power of your eyes? It should be there, because you are using your eyes to see the flower. And of course, eyes are more beautiful than any flower, because all flowers have to come through the eyes. It is through the eyes that you have become aware of the world of flowers. But have you ever felt the power of the eyes? They are almost dull, dead. They have become passive. Just like windows, receptive. They don't go to their object. And power means being active. Power means your eyes going and almost touching the flowers, your ears going and almost touching the songs of the birds, your hands going with the total energy in you, focused there and touching your beloved. or you are lying down on the grass and your whole body full of power meeting a contact with the grass, having a dialogue with the grass, or you are swimming in the river and whispering with the river and listening to the whispers of the river, connected in communion. But power is needed. So the first thing I would like you to do is, when you see, really see, become the eyes, forget everything, let your whole energy flow through the eyes, and your eyes will be cleaned, bathed in an inner shower, and you will be able to see that these trees are no more the same. The greenery is no more the same. It has become greener, as if dust has disappeared from it. The dust was not on the trees, it was on your eyes. And you will see for the first time, and you will hear for the first time. Jesus goes on saying to his disciples, if you have ears, listen. If you have eyes, see. They were not all blind, and they were not all deaf. What he means? He means that you have almost become deaf and almost become blind. You see and yet you don't see. You hear yet you don't hear. It is not a power. It is not energy. It is not vital. Performing Saima on their power of cognition, real nature, then you will be able to see what is the real nature of your senses. It is divine. Your body embodies the divine. It is God who has looked through your eyes. I remember Mr. Eckhart's famous saying. The day he realized and became enlightened, his friends and disciples and brothers asked, "What have you seen?" He laughed. He is the only one in the whole Christianity who comes very close to Zen masters, almost a Zen master. He laughed, he said, "I have not seen him, he has seen himself through me. God has seen himself through me. These eyes are his." And what a game, what a play. He has seen himself through me. When you really feel the nature of your senses, you will feel it is divine. It is God who has moved through your hands. It is God's hands. All hands are His. It is God who has loved through you. All love affairs are His. And how it can be otherwise? Hindus call it Leela, God's play. It is He who is calling you through the cuckoo. And it is He who is listening through you. It is He and He alone, spread all over. Performing Saima on their power of cognition, real nature, egoism, all pervasiveness and functions bring mastery over the sense organs. This word egoism has to be understood, because in Sanskrit we have three words for the ego, and in English there is only one word. That creates difficulty. The Sanskrit word in the sutra is asmita. So let me first explain to you. There are three words: ahankar, asmita, atma. All mean I. Ahankar can be translated as the ego, the very grass. Too much emphasis on I. For asmita there is no word in English. Asmita means amness. I am. In ego, the emphasis is on I. In asmita, the emphasis is on am. Amness. Purer than ego. Still it is there, but in a very different form. Amness and Atma, even amness has disappeared. In the ego, I am. In Asmita, only am. In Atma, even that has disappeared. In Atma, there is pure being. Neither I nor amness. In this sutra, asmita is used. Amness. Remember, the ego is of the mind. Senses have no ego. They have a certain amness, but no ego. The ego is of the mind. Your eyes don't have any ego. Your hands don't have any ego. They have a certain amness. That's why if your skin has to be replaced and somebody else's skin is planted on you, your body will reject it. Because the body knows it is not mine. So your own skin has to be replaced from some other part of the body, from your thighs. Your own skin has to be replaced, otherwise the body will reject. The body will not accept it. It is not mine. The body has no I, but it has an amness. If you need blood, anybody's blood won't do. The body will not accept all sorts of blood. Only a particular blood. It has its own amness. That will be accepted. Some other blood will be rejected. The body has its own feel of its being. Very unconscious, very subtle and pure, but it is there. Your eyes are yours. Just like your thumbprints. Everything yours is yours. Now physiologists say that everybody's heart is different, of a different shape. In the books of physiology, the picture that you will find is not a real picture. It is just average. It is just imagined. Otherwise, each person's heart has a different shape. Even each person's kidney has a different shape. These parts all have their signatures. Everybody is so unique. That is the amness. You will never be again here. You have never been before. So move cautiously and alertly and happily. Just think the glory of your being. Just think that you are so superb and unique. God has wasted much in you. Never imitate, because that will be a betrayal. Be yourself. Let that be your religion. All else is politics. Don't be a Hindu. Don't be a Mohammedan. Don't be a Christian. Be religious. But there is only one religion, and that is just being yourself, authentically yourself. Performing saima on their power of cognition, real nature, asmita, the subtle amness, all pervasiveness and functions brings mastery over the sense organs. And if you meditate on these things, you will become a master. Meditation brings mastery. Nothing else brings mastery except meditation. If you meditate on your eyes, first you will see the rose flower. By and by you will be able to see the eye that is seeing. Then you have become a master of the eye. Once you have seen the seeing eye, you have become a master. Now you can use all its energies, and they are all pervasive. Your eyes are not as limited as you think them to be. They can see many more things which you have not seen. They can penetrate many more mysteries that you have not even dreamed about. But you are not master of your eyes, and you have used them in a very haphazard way, not knowing what you are doing. And with objects too much in contact, you have forgotten the subjectivity of your eyes. It happens. If you keep company with someone, by and by you become influenced by. You have been too much in contact with objects, and you have forgotten the inner quality of your senses. You see things, but you never see your seeing. You hear the sounds, but you never hear the subtle vibration that goes on within you, the sound of your being. Let me tell you one anecdote. I have heard that one extremely confident tramp had enormous nerve. He had just completed a very large meal in a swanky restaurant when he announced to the manager, "My good man, I have really enjoyed your food, but unfortunately I cannot afford to pay for any of it at all. I have not a penny to my name. Now don't get angry. I am by profession a beggar, as you may see. I happen to be an extremely talented beggar too. I can go out and within 1 hour get the money I owe you for this meal. Naturally though, you cannot trust me to come back, and this I fully understand. You would be most welcome to accompany me, but can a man like you, a well-known restaurant owner, afford to be seen with a man of my caliber? No. So I have, sir, the perfect solution to our little problem. I will wait here and you go out and beg until you have the cost of this meal." If you keep company with a beggar, you will become a beggar. He will suggest in 1001 ways to you to become like him. We have kept company with the object so long that we have forgotten our subjectivity. We have remained focused outwardly so long on things that we have forgotten that we are persons. This long association with objects has completely destroyed your image of yourself. You have to come back home. In yoga, when you start seeing your seeing eye, you come across a subtle energy, they call it tanmatra. When you can see your eye seeing, just hidden behind the eyes, you see tremendous energy. That is tanmatra, the energy of the eye. Behind the ear you see tremendous energy accumulated, tanmatra of the ear. Behind your genital organs you see tremendous energy accumulated, tanmatra of sexuality, and so on and so forth. Everywhere behind your senses there is a pool of energy, unused. Once you know it, you can pour that energy into your eyes, and then you will see visions which only sometimes poets see, painters see. Then you will hear sounds which sometimes only musicians hear, poets hear. And then you will touch things which only sometimes in rare moments lovers know how to touch. You will become alive, streaming. Ordinarily, you have been taught to repress your senses, not to know them. It is very foolish, but very convenient. It happened after the rural wedding. The bride and the groom climbed into the wagon and set out for their farm home. About a mile down the road, the horse stumbled. "That's one," shouted the groom. They continued on, and the horse stumbled again. "That is two," shouted the groom. As they neared the farm, the horse stumbled again. "That is three," shouted the groom, and seizing a gun from behind the seat, put a bullet through the horse's brain. The bride sat aghast. Then in no uncertain terms she told her new husband what she thought of his action. He sat quietly until she subsided, then pointed at her and shouted, "That is one." The couple lived happily for 60 years. But that happiness cannot be a real happiness. Easy to repress at the point of a gun. But then what sort of love will happen between these two people? The gun will always stand in between. And the wife will always be afraid, now any moment he is going to say, "Now this is two. Now this is three," and finished. That's what you have done with your senses, with your body. You have repressed it. But you were helpless. I don't say that you are responsible for repressing it. You were brought up in such a way. Nobody allowed your senses freedom. In the name of love, only repression continues. The mothers, the fathers, the society, they go on repressing. By and by, they teach you a trick. And the trick is not to accept yourself, deny. Everything has to be channelized into conformity. Your wilderness has to be thrown into the dark part of your soul, and a small corner has to be clean like a drawing room, where you can see people, meet people and live and forget all about your wilder being, your real existence. Your fathers and your mothers are not responsible either, because they were brought up in the same way. So nobody is responsible. But once you know it and you don't do anything, then you become responsible. Being near me, I am going to make you very, very responsible. Because you will know it, and then if you don't do anything, then you cannot throw the responsibility on anybody else. Then you are going to be responsible. Now you know that how you have destroyed your senses, and you know also how to revive them. Do something. Throw the gun completely, the repressive mind completely. Unblock yourself. Start flowing again. Start connecting again with your being. Start connecting with your senses again. You are as if a telephone line disconnected. Everything looks perfectly okay. The telephone is there, but the line is disconnected. Your eyes are there, your hands are there, your ears are there, but the line is disconnected. Reconnect it. If it can be disconnected, it can be reconnected. Others have disconnected it because they were also taught in the same way. But you can reconnect it. All my meditations are to give you a streaming energy. That's why I call them dynamic methods. Old meditations were just to sit silently, not to do anything. I give you active methods. Because when you are streaming with energy, you can sit silently, that will do. But right now, first you have to become alive. From this follows instantaneous cognition without the use of the body and complete mastery over pradhana, prakriti, the material world. If you can see tanmatras, the subtle energies of your senses, you will become capable of using your cognition without the grosser instruments. If you know that behind the eye there is accumulated pool of energy, you can close your eyes and use that energy directly. Then you will be able to see without opening your eyes. That's what telepathy, clairvoyance, clairaudience is. In Soviet Russia, there is a woman who has been investigated scientifically, who stands just 20 feet away from any object and starts pulling it just by energy. She makes the movements by her hands 20 feet away, as you have seen making passes, a hypnotist making passes. She simply draws gestures. Within 15 minutes, things start moving towards her. She has not touched them. Much investigation has been done. What happens? And that woman loses at least 0.5 pound of weight in a 1/2 hour experiment. Certainly, some sort of energy she is losing. This is what yoga calls tanmatra. Ordinarily, you use the energy through the hands when you take something up, a stone, a rock, you carry it. You use the same energy through the hands. But if you know the energy directly, you can drop the use of the hand. The energy can directly move the object. The same way, telepathy, you can hear or read people's thoughts, or can see faraway scenes. Once you know the tanmatra, the subtle energy that is being used by your eyes, eyes can be discarded. Once you know that it is not really the sense that is functioning but the energy, you are freed of the sense. I have heard a story. So this guy phoned Cohen and Goldberg, wholesalers. Put me through to Mr. Cohen, please. I am afraid Mr. Cohen has gone out, sir. said the switchboard girl. Then get me Mr. Goldberg. I am afraid Mr. Goldberg is tied up at present, sir. Okay, I will phone back later. 10 minutes later, Mr. Goldberg, please. I am afraid Mr. Goldberg is still tied up, sir. I will phone back. 30 minutes later, get me Mr. Goldberg. I am terribly sorry, sir, but Mr. Goldberg is still tied up. I will phone back. 30 minutes later, Goldberg, I have dreadful news for you, sir. Mr. Goldberg is still tied up. But look, this is ridiculous. How can you run a business like that? The one partner is out all morning and the other is tied up for hours on end. What is going on there? Well, you see, sir, whenever Mr. Cohen goes out, he ties up Mr. Goldberg. This is what is happening inside you also. Whenever you go out, throw the eyes, throw the hands, throw your genital organs, throw your ears. Whenever you go out, continuously a certain type of bondage and tying is created. By and by, you become tied with the particular sense, eyes, ears, because that is from there you go out again, again, again. By and by, you forget the energy that is going out. This getting into bondage with senses is the whole world, the sansar. How to untie yourself from the senses? And once you are tied up with the senses, you start thinking in terms of them. You forget yourself. Another story. A disciple wanted very much to renounce the world and follow his guru, but he said that his wife and family loved him too much and he was unable to leave his home. The guru came up with a plan. The man was taught certain yogic secrets so that he could give the appearance to all who looked upon his body that he was deceased. The next day the man followed instructions and his body was besieged with the wailings and sobbings of his wife and family. The guru appeared at the door in the guise of a magician and told the family that if they loved this man so much, he could bring him back to life. He said that the man would live if someone would die in his place by drinking the potion he had. Each member of the family had an excuse that it made necessary to keep him his own life, and the wife added, anyway, he is already dead, we will manage. At this the yogi stood up and said, woman, if you can live without me, then I can go with my guru. He faced the teacher and said, let us go, sir. Reverend Master, I will follow you. The whole attachment with the senses is as if you are the senses, as if you cannot live without them, as if your whole life is confined to them. But you are not confined to them. You can renounce them. And you can live still and live on a higher plane. Difficult, just as if you want to pursue a seed that dies and soon a beautiful plant will be born. How can he believe? Because he will be dead. And no seed has ever known that by his death a new sprout comes of, a new life arises. So how to believe it? Or if you go near an egg and you want to pursue the word within, that come out. But how the word has to believe it, that there is any possibility of life without the egg? Or if you talk to a child inside the womb of a mother and tell him that come out, don't be afraid. But he knows nothing outside the womb. The womb has been his whole life. He knows only that much. He is afraid. The same is the situation. Surrounded by the senses, we live in a sort of confinement and imprisonment. One has to be a little daring, courageous. Right now, wherever you are and whatsoever you are, nothing is happening to you. Then take risk. Then move into the unknown. Then try to find out a new way of life. From this follows instantaneous cognition without the use of the body and complete mastery over prakriti, the material world. Up to now you have been possessed by the material world. Once you know that you have your own energy totally independent from the material world, you become a master. No more the world possesses you. You possess it. Only those who renounce become the real masters. Only after the awareness of the distinction between sattva and purusa does supremacy and knowledge arise over all states of existence. And the subtlest discrimination has to be made between sattva and purusa, intelligence and awareness. It is very easy to separate yourself from the body. The body is so grass, you can feel it, you cannot be it. You must be inside it. It is easy to see that you cannot be the eyes. You must be someone hidden behind who looks through the eyes. Otherwise, who will look through the eyes? Your glasses cannot look. Behind the glasses, eyes are needed. Your eyes also like glasses. They are glasses. They cannot look. You are needed somewhere behind to look. But the subtlest identification is with intelligence. Your power to think. Your power of intellect, understanding, that is the subtlest thing. It is very difficult to discriminate between awareness and intelligence. But it can be discriminated by and by, step first. Know that you are not the body. Let that understanding grow deep, crystallize. Then know that you are not the senses. Let that understanding grow, crystallize. Then know that you are not the tanmatras, the energy pools behind the senses. Let that grow and crystallize. And then you will be able to see that intelligence is also a pool of energy. It is the common pool in which eyes pour their energy, ears pour their energy, hands pour their energy. All the senses are like rivers, and intelligence is the central thing in which they bring information and pour. Whatsoever your mind knows is given by the senses. You have seen colors, your mind knows. If you are color blind, if you cannot see the color green, then your mind does not know anything about the green. Bernard Shaw lived his whole life unaware that he was color blind. It is very difficult to come to know it, but one accidental incident allowed him to become aware. On one of his birthdays, somebody has presented him a suit, but the tie was missing. So he went to the market to find out a tie which can fit with the suit. The suit was green, and he started purchasing a yellow tie. His secretary was watching, and she said, "What are you doing? It won't fit. The suit is green and the tie is yellow." He said, "Is there any difference between these two?" For 70 years he has lived not knowing that he cannot see yellow. He sees green, whether it is yellow or green. Both the colors look green. Now, yellow was no more part of his mind. The eyes never poured that information into the mind. The eyes are like servants, information collectors, PROs, roaming all over the world, collecting things, pouring into the mind. They go on feeding the mind. Mind is the central pool. First, you have to become aware that you are not the eye, not the energy that is hidden behind the eye. Then you will be able to see that every sense is pouring into the mind. You are not this mind also. You are the one who is seeing it being poured. You are just standing on the bank, all the rivers pouring into the ocean. You are the watcher, the witness. Swami Ram has said, "Science is difficult to define, but perhaps the most essential feature of it involves the study of something which is external to the observer. The techniques of meditation offer an approach which allows one to be external to one's own internal states. The techniques of meditation offer an approach which allows one to be external to one's own internal states. And the ultimate of meditation is to know that whatsoever you can know, you are not it. Whatsoever can be reduced as a known object, you are not it. Because you cannot be reduced to be an object. You remain eternally subject. The knower, the knower, the knower, and the knower can never be reduced to the known." This is purusa, awareness. This is the final understanding that arises out of yoga. It is very difficult to be non-attached in the world, but it is even more difficult to be non-attached when the spiritual world opens its doors. The difficulty of the second is a millionfold. Because the worldly powers are not real powers. They are impotent. And they never satisfy you. They never make you contented. In fact, every new achievement in the world creates more desires. Rather than satisfying you, it sends your mind into new trips, So whatsoever power you attain in the world, you use it only to create new desires. Whatsoever money you can gather in the world, you invest it to gain more money. Then the more money comes, you invest it for still more money. And this way it goes on. Only means and means and means, and never the end comes closer. So even a stupid person becomes aware sooner or later that he is moving in a vicious circle, and there seems to be no way out of it except to drop out. For an intelligent person, one who thinks about his life, meditates about it, it is very obvious. So non-attachment is not so difficult in the worldly things. But when it comes to the inner powers, the psychic powers, they are so close to your being and so infinitely satisfying, it is almost impossible to be non-attached to them. But if you are not, then you have again created a world, and you will remain far, far away from the ultimate liberation. Because whatsoever you possess, possesses you. The sacrifice has to be total, utterly total. You have to drop everything that you can possess, except your nude nature. That which cannot be sacrificed, only that can be left. That which can be sacrificed should be sacrificed. In this sutra, Patanjali is asking almost the impossible. But that too becomes possible through understanding. It is very satisfying, gratifying to have spiritual powers. And it gives you such a subtle joy of the ego, so pure, that you cannot feel any sting in it. It never frustrates you. In the world there is much frustration, in fact nothing but frustration. It is a miracle how people can avoid seeing this. It is a miracle how people can go on deceiving themselves and believing that there is some hope. The outside world is hopeless. It is doomed. Howsoever big house you can make, or howsoever powerful you become politically, economically, socially, death is going to take them all away from you. And not much intelligence is needed to understand this. But the inner powers, death cannot take them away. They are beyond death. And they never frustrate you. They are your powers, your potentialities come to flower. There seems to be no need to sacrifice them, no need to renounce them, but Patanjali is asking they have also to be renounced. Otherwise you will start living in a world of visions. Again the power trip. And religion is not a power trip. You are not seeking the ego. but you are trying to find out the whole. And the whole is possible only when all sorts of egoistic trips are dropped and sacrificed. When you are not, God is. Let me tell you one very famous Sufi story. The Holy Shadow. There once lived a saint so good that the angels came from heaven to see how a man could be so godly. This saint went about his daily life diffusing virtue as the stars diffuse light and the flowers scent, without being aware of it. His day could be summed up by two words: he gave, he forgave. Yet these words never passed his lips. They were expressed in his ready smile, his kindness, forbearance and charity. The angels said to God, "Lord, grant him the gift of miracles." God replied, "Ask what it is that he wishes." They said to the saint, "Would you like the touch of your hands to heal the sick?" "No," answered the saint, "I would rather God do that." "Would you like to convert guilty souls and bring back wandering hearts to the right path?" "No, that is the angel's mission. It is not for me to convert." "Would you like to become a model of patience, attracting men by the luster of your virtues and thus glorifying God?" "No," replied the saint. "If men should be attracted to me, they would become estranged from God." "What is it that you desire then?" asked the angels. "What can I wish for?" asked the saint, smiling. "That God gives me his grace. With that, would I not have everything?" The angel said, "You must ask for a miracle, or one will be forced upon you." "Very well," said the saint, "that I may do a great deal of good without ever knowing it." The angels were perplexed. They took counsel and resolved upon the following plan. Every time the saint said or fell behind him or to either side, so that he could not see it, it would have the power to cure disease, soothe pain, and comfort sorrow. When the saint walked along, his shadow thrown on the ground on either side or behind him made arid paths green, caused withered plants to bloom, gave clear water to dried up brooks, fresh color to pale children, and joy to unhappy men and women. The saint simply went about his daily life diffusing virtue as the stars diffuse light and the flowers scent, without being aware of it. The people, respecting his humility, followed him silently, never speaking to him about his miracles. Soon they even forgot his name and called him the Holy Shadow. This is the ultimate. One has to become the Holy Shadow. Just a shadow of God. This is the greatest revolution that can happen to a human being, the transfer of the center. You are no more your own center. God becomes your center. You live like his shadow. You are not powerful because you don't have any center to be powerful. You are not virtuous. You don't have any center to be virtuous. You are not even religious. You don't have any center to be religious. You are simply not. A tremendous emptiness with no barriers and blocks, so the divine can flow through you unhindered. uninterpreted, untouched. So the divine can flow through you as he is, not as you would like him to be. He does not pass through your center. There is none. The center is last. This is the meaning of this sutra, that finally you have to sacrifice your center. So you cannot think in terms of the ego again. You cannot utter I. To annihilate yourself utterly, to erase yourself utterly. Nothing belongs to you. On the contrary, you belong to God. You become a holy shadow. It is difficult to conceive it, because it is so difficult to be unattached with useless rubbish. You go on collecting in the hope as if whatsoever you accumulates fulfills you. You go on accumulating knowledge, money, power, prestige. You go on just accumulating. Your whole life is a stuffing in. And of course, if you become a dead weight, there is no wonder in it. That's what you have been doing, collecting dust and thinking it as if it is gold. The valueless becomes of immense value if looked through the ego. The ego is the great falsifier, the great deceiver. It goes on lying to you, and it goes on creating illusions, dreams, projections. Watch it. It is very subtle. Its ways are subtle, and it is very cunning. If you stop it in one direction, it moves in another direction. If you stop one path, it finds another path. And in such a cunning way that you cannot think that the other path is also of the ego. About an old woman, who had fallen down the stairs and broke her leg. The doctor put it in a cast and warned her not to walk up down the stairs. It finally mended after 6 months, and the doctor announced the cast could be removed. "Can I climb the stairs now?" asked the old lady. "Yes," said the doctor. "Ah, I am glad," she giggled. "I am sick of going up and down the drain pipe." If you block, the ego coming from the staircase, it comes from the drain pipe. But it comes. You see your so-called religious men. They have renounced all. But they have not renounced renunciation. They have renounced all. Now they are clinging to their renunciation. That renunciation has become their wealth, the drain pipe. Now they are climbing to the same ego, but in a more cunning and subtle way. So subtle that not only others are deceived, they themselves are deceived. Watch. You are a worldly man. Then one day, you feel the frustration. One day everybody feels it. There is nothing special in it. then you start becoming religious and you start feeling very egoistic about it. You are becoming religious. You look at others as sinners. Worldly people, you are religious. You have become a sannyasin. You have renounced. Just watch. The enemy has entered from another door. The world is not to be renounced. The ego has to be renounced. So one has to be very, very careful not to allow it. The ego cannot be repressed, remember. It has to be simply evaporated through the heat of understanding, through the fire of understanding. If you repress it, it is easy. You can become humble. You can become simple. But it will hide behind your simplicity. A woman told her doctor that she was convinced she had a very dangerous illness. He advised her not to be so foolish, that she could not possibly know whether she had it or not, because the disease, he added, carries with it no discomfort whatsoever. So there is no way for her to know. The lady said, but doctor, she told him, that's exactly how I feel. No discomfort whatsoever. The disease is there. You can go on deceiving yourself and you can find rationalizations. And on the surface, they look very reasonable. On the surface, they look almost like proofs. But look into them. And it is nobody else's business, remember. It is for you to see. The whole world can see it, but if you have not seen it, that is useless. Now, a modern psychology is by and by turning from individual therapy to group therapy. And the only reason for it is this, that it is very difficult for the psychoanalyst to convince the patient person to person about what he is doing to himself. About the patient, about his complexes, about his rationalizations, repressions, about his deceptions, stupidities. It is very difficult to convince him person to person. But in a group it becomes easier, because the whole group can see the foolishness, the obviousness of it. That he is clinging to something and unnecessarily becoming miserable. The whole group can see it, and the understanding of the whole group functions tremendously and deeply than the understanding of one person can function on you. That's why group therapy is growing, individual therapy is disappearing. Group therapy has a tremendous advantage. 20 persons working in a group, 19 persons have become alert that you are doing something which you don't want to do and still you are clinging to it. A sannyasin came to me, a very good man. But he was feeling very, very happy because I have given him a beautiful name. I give beautiful names to everybody. He has made an ego trip out of it. He said, Bhagwan, you are wonderful. You have given me such a beautiful name. It exactly represents me. Your names don't represent you. These are my hopes, not realities. These are my dreams, not realities. I have called that sannyasin Satyananda, the bliss that arises out of the experience of truth. And that is the ultimate. What is that, Bhagwan? Satyananda, you have exactly got me. I am so impressed by your understanding. Now, I became alert that this has been very, very wrong. It has been a misunderstanding. I should not have given him this name. I wanted him to pull down from his euphoria. So after a few minutes, he started saying that I don't want anger, greed, this and that. These are all animalistic. I said, don't be a coward. Immediately he exploded. Coward? You called me coward? He was almost ready to hit me. He screamed. Completely forgot about Satyananda. And he started defending himself that why you called me coward? I am not a coward. And I told him, if you are not a coward, then why you are defending? Then simply you can say, you are wrong. Or even that is not needed. You are not a coward, why you are worried about it? Why you have got so heart red? Why you are screaming at the top of your voice? Why you have got so mad? I must have touched something. Now everybody who was present became aware that the man is defending something and defending very fanatically. But only he could not see it. In a group, if you work for a longer time, by and by, you have to become aware that the whole group is seeing that you are doing something foolish, stupid, contrary to your own wishes, against to your own fulfillment, against your own growth. You are clinging to a disease and you go on saying that I want to get rid of it. Almost everybody knows where you are doing wrong, except you. Everybody knows that you are egoist, except you. Only you think you are a humble man, a simple man. Everybody knows your complexity. Everybody knows your double bind. Everybody knows your madness, except you. You go on defending it. And because of politeness, etiquette, formalities, in the society nobody will tell you. Hence, the group is helpful because it is not going to be polite. It is going to be truthful. And when so many people say that this is your problem and pinpoint it and finger it and put their fingers on your wound and it hurts, it is very difficult to make you alert individual to individual because you can think this man may be wrong. But 20 persons, the possibility of 20 persons being wrong is less and you have to fall back upon yourself and see the point of it. That's why Buddha created a great Sangha, a great order of monks, 10,000 monks. It was the first experiment of group therapy. It was a great experiment. That's what I'm doing. 16,000 sannyasins. One of the greatest experiment in therapy. A community, a commune, in which you have to become aware, because otherwise you will not be part of this commune, where everybody is understanding and seeing your errors and showing it to you, because sannyasins are not meant to be polite or formal. None of that rubbish. A sannyasin is here to transform himself and become a situation for others' transformation. See, whenever somebody points at some fault about you, don't get angry. That is not going to help you. Don't get mad. That is not going to help you. Try to see the point. Maybe the other is true, and there is more possibility for the other to be true, because he is so detached from you. He is so far away from you. He is not involved in you. Always listen to people, what they are saying about you. 99% they will be right. There is only 1% possibility they may be wrong. Otherwise they are not wrong. How they can be wrong? Because they have a detached view about you. That's why a master is needed to show you your wounds. And it is possible only if you are in deep respect and trust. If you get angry and you start fighting, then there is no trust and no respect. If you are here to defend your illnesses and diseases, then it is for you. Don't be here. What is the point of wasting your time here? If I say that you are a coward and you cannot see the point, rather you have to fight and prove to me that you are not, then just there is no point of being here. The relationship is finished with me. Now I cannot be helpful to you. When I say something to you, you have to look into the fact. Why should I say you a coward? There is no investment with you, and in your cowardness I have not invested anything. I simply say so because of compassion, because I see the illness is there. And unless you know it, unless it is diagnosed, how you are going to get rid of it? If the doctor puts his hand on your pulse and says that you have fever, and you jump on him and start fighting, what are you saying? How I can have ever any fever? No. You are wrong. I am perfectly healthy. Then why in the first place you had gone to the doctor? Just to get a certificate of health? You are here, remember it. You are not here to get recognition for your illnesses and certificates that they don't exist there. You are here to be diagnosed, dissected, destroyed, so that your real nature can arise, bloom. But if you are defending, then it is for you to defend. It is none of my business. You defend it. But then you will suffer. Then don't come and tell me that I am suffering, that I am tense. From from the world, it is very difficult to move inwards, because inwards you have been hiding illnesses and diseases. They force you to go out. That's a way of diverting the attention. That's why so many masters have been teaching you, go in, know thyself, but you never go there. You talk about it. You read about it. You appreciate the idea, but you never go in. Because in you have only darkness and wounds and diseases. You have been hiding things which are not good, not healthy to you. You have been, on the contrary, protecting them rather than destroying them. Now you open the door and such stinking you start feeling, such dirt, such ugliness, a hell opens. You immediately close the door and you start thinking, what is the matter? Buddha, Jesus, Krishna, they all have been teaching, go in and you will be tremendously blissful, eternally blissful. But you open the door and you move in a nightmare. This nightmare is created by your repressions. On the surface you are simple. Deep down you are very complex. On the surface you have a face of a very innocent man. Deep down you are very ugly. Because of that repressiveness, you cannot look within and you have to continuously divert yourself into something. Listening to the radio, seeing the TV, reading the newspaper, going to see friends, just wasting time somewhere till you fall asleep. The moment you are awake, you start running again. From whom you are running? You are running from yourself. Give space to yourself to see your being. Then suddenly you will see that there is no attachment with things. How it can be? It is absurd. I have heard one very beautiful story, a Sufi story, the Golden Door. Two men prayed and went their separate ways. One gathered wealth and power. People said he was famous, but there was no peace in him. The other saw the hearts of men glowing as lamps even in the darkness of their own secret fears. He too had found richness and power, and his wealth, his power was love. When simply, kindly, tenderly he touched his fellow man with all the richness and power of this love, the light within grew clear and bright with courage and with peace. Both men one day stood before that golden door through which all men must pass to the greater life beyond. The angel in the soul of each asked, what do you bring with you? What have you to give? God always asks. What do you bring with you? What have you to give? God goes on giving to you, but finally, the last day, before you enter into his innermost shrine, he asks, now, what you have brought for me? What's your gift for me? The one who was famous recounted his exploits. Why? There was no end to the people he knew, and the places he had been, and the things he had done, and the things he has accumulated. But the angel answered, these are not acceptable. These things that you did for yourself. I see no love in them. If there is ego, there cannot be love. Remember this, I am going to discuss about it later on, because it is one of the most important things. If there is ego, there can be no love. And the famous one sank outside the golden door and wept. for the first time he could see the whole futility of all his efforts. It was almost like a dream that has passed and his hands are empty. If you are too full of things, one day or other you will see your hands are empty. It was dream stuff that you were carrying in your hands. They have always been empty. You were just dreaming that something is there. Because you were afraid of emptiness, you had projected something. You had believed. You had never looked deeply whether really it is there or not. And the famous man sank outside the golden door and wept. He had been too busy to be kind, too occupied to love, too engaged to be himself, too concerned with futile things to be concerned with the essential. Then the angel in the soul of the other asked, "And what do you bring? What have you to give?" And he answered, saying, "No one knows my name. They call me the wanderer, the dreamer. I have only a little light in my heart, and that which I have shared with the soul of man." The real people look like dreamers in this world of mad people. Always the sages have been known as wanderers, dreamers, poets. Imaginative, living somewhere, lotus eaters, navel gazers, this type of labels have been given to real people because the world belongs to paper people. They are not real. Paper people, whenever they come across a real person, call him dreamer, poet. That is their way of condemning him. And that is their way of defending themselves. And he answered, saying, "No one knows my name. They called me the wanderer, the dreamer. I have only a little light in my heart. Nothing else. Just a little light in my heart. And that which I have shared with the souls of men." Then the angel said, "Ah, blessed one, you have the greatest gift of all. It is love. Always and always, there is enough and spare. Enter." That's the beauty of love. The more you give, the more you have it. Let this be a criterion in your life. Don't accumulate that which by giving disappears. Only accumulate that which by giving accumulates. Only accumulate that which by sharing increases and grows. That is worth which you can share, and by its very sharing it grows. And you have more than before. Always and always there is enough and spare. Enter. Then said the wanderer, "But first let me give the extra measure to my brothers, that we may both walk through the door." The angel was silent, for in that moment a great light shone around the simple wanderer like a radiant mantle, enveloping both himself and his friends. The golden door was opened wide and they walked through it together. He shares at the very last moment also. This is real richness. A miser is never a rich. If you are attached to things in the world, you are not rich. richness arises out of the heart. Richness is a quality of the heart glowing with love. One of the greatest poets of India, Rabindranath Tagore, has written a poem. Beloved of my heart, in essence, the poem means this. One day, in a small village in Bengal, an ascetic woman from the neighborhood came to see me. And this is not only a poem, it is based on a real incident. She had the name of Sarva Kipi given to her by the village people, the meaning of which is the woman who is mad about all things. Sarva Kipi, who is mad about all things. Not only in one thing she is mad, but in all things she is mad. Absolute mad. She fixed her star-like eyes upon my face and startled me with the question, when are you coming to meet me underneath the trees? Evidently she pitied me, who lived according to her, prisoned behind walls, banished away from the great meeting place of the all where she had her dwelling. Just at that moment my gardener came with his basket, and when the woman understood that the flowers in the vase on my table were going to be thrown away to make place for the fresh ones, she looked pained and said to me, "You are always engaged reading and writing. You do not see." Then she took the discarded flowers in her palms, kissed them and touched them with her forehead, and reverently murmured to herself, "Beloved of my heart." I felt that this woman, in her direct vision of the infinite personality in the heart of all things, truly represented the spirit of the East. Love is the spirit of the East. Love is the spirit of man. Love is the spirit of God. Love is the only richness there is, the only happiness there is. Now, if you are attached to things, you cannot be a lover. Only a non-attached man can rise himself, raise himself towards that sky which we call love. There is much misunderstanding about it. People who leave the world and become detached almost simultaneously become loveless also. Then something has gone wrong. Because love is the criterion, the very test, the touchstone. If your non-attachment to the world makes you loveless, something has gone sour. Your non-attachment is not true, authentic, real. It is pseudo. Because you are afraid of love, that shows you are afraid of being attached. So you avoid all situations where love can flower, because you are afraid deep down that if love flowers, you will become attached again. So that's why your so-called Mahatmas are so much afraid of love. They will not stay in one place for more than 3 days. Why so much fear? Because if you remain in one place for many more days, you will start feeling love for people. Somebody will come every day to massage your feet and you will start feeling love for him. Somebody will bring food for you every day, and you will start feeling love for her. A certain affection will arise, and the fear of being attached again. Move before you become attached. These so-called non-attached people are simply afraid people. They live in deep panic. They can never touch the real core of life, because it is always touched by love. Remember, if your non-attachment to things is true, has come out of understanding, has grown out of awareness, you will become more loving. Because the same energy that was involved in attachment will be released where it will go. You will have more energy at your disposal. Attachment is not love. It is an ego trip to possess, to dominate, to manipulate. It is violence, it is not love. When this energy is relieved, suddenly you have much more energy to love. A really non-attached person is full of love, and always he has to give more and more. And always he goes on finding new sources of love. His source is infinite. By being non-attached even to these powers, and the ultimate non-attachment comes when you have attained some miracles, siddhis, powers, when you can do things. Things which are miraculous, things which are unbelievable. If you become attached to them, sooner or later you will be back in the world again. Beware. It is the ego's last attack on you. Don't be caught. The ego is throwing its last net on you. By being non-attached to even these powers, the seed of bondage is destroyed. The seed of bondage is attachment. And the seed of liberation is love. And how alike they look. They are diametrically opposite. Attachment is lovelessness. Love is always non-attached. Where is the difference? You love a woman or a man, and you feel attached. Why you feel attached? Attachment means that tomorrow also you would like to have this woman with you. That's all. Tomorrow and again, day after tomorrow, you would like to have this woman in your possession. That simply shows you have not been able to love today. Otherwise the tomorrow never enters. Who bothers about tomorrow? Who knows about tomorrow? Tomorrow never comes. It enters only into the mind who has been not living today. You have not loved this woman today. So you are waiting for tomorrow to come so that you can love. Your love is incomplete, unfinished. For that unfinished love, attachment arises. Then it is natural, logical. You are painting, and the painting is incomplete. You would like to have the canvas tomorrow also to complete it. There is a very deep lie in life. It wants to complete everything. The bird wants to flower. the seed wants to become a sprout. Everything is moving towards completion. So whatsoever you leave incomplete becomes a desire in the mind and says, possess this woman, you have not loved yet. You have not yet traveled through her being through and through. Still much unknown territory remains in her. Still much potentiality which has not been actualized is there. Many songs of being and many dances to be danced. Attachment arises. Tomorrow is needed. Day after tomorrow is needed. Future is needed. And if you are really incapable of living in the present, then a future life is also needed. And people go on promising each other that we will remain spouses in the future life also. That simply shows these people have become absolutely incapable of living. Otherwise, this day is enough unto itself. This moment, if you complete your love, if you have loved with your full heart, totally surrendered, dissolved into it, you have not been holding anything back, then never the idea of tomorrow arises. It is impossible for the idea of tomorrow to arise. It always comes when something is unfulfilled. Then you hanker for the future. If you have loved your woman today and death comes, you will accept. Or if the woman falls in love with somebody else, you will say a goodbye. Sad, but not miserable. And sadness has a beauty and misery is ugly. Sad, not because of attachment. Sad, because your love is still there, arising in you. And the person is going away. Who could have understood it? Sad, but fulfilled. There is no complaint, no grudge. But if you have loved totally, this never happens, that the woman can go or the man can go. If you have loved totally, it is impossible. Because that total love satisfies so deeply. One cannot even think of others. It is impossible to dream of the other. The dream arises only because of dissatisfaction with this one. You think of other women because with your own woman it has not been a satisfactory relationship. You think of other men because the mind wants to pour itself. And this has not happened in this relationship. So the mind goes on wandering all over the place. Any woman that passes by the road, you start feeling love for her or for man. And if your love has become so much frustrated that you cannot imagine now that it is possible to love any human being, you start loving dogs and cats. Seems to be less complicated. Alok should make a note of it. Seems to be less complicated. Loving a dog is very simple. Loving a cat a little more difficult. That's why men call women cats. A cat is less predictable than the dog, more clever than the dog, has her own mind. You can kick the dog and he will come again. You kick the cat, she will not come again. Finished. Always ready for the divorce. People fall in love with animals. Unfortunate. I'm not saying don't love animals. I'm saying don't make them substitutes for human beings. You should love human beings so deeply that your love starts overflowing and it reaches to animals also. Then it is totally different. Then it reaches to the trees also. Then it is totally different. To the rocks also. Because you go on overflowing. An infinite source of love. Nobody can contain your love. It goes on overflowing, overflowing, overflowing. Then it reaches to animals. Then it is sad. Totally different quality to it. But the doors with humans are closed and you have to find someone to love, otherwise you feel very much frustrated. A relationship is needed. Then you relate with dogs, cats. Even that too proves sometimes to be unsatisfactory, because dogs are people. Cats are people. They have also their own ideologies, their own ideas, and they want to do their thing. No dog is there to fulfill your desires. You may be thinking while you are taking a dog for a walk that you have tamed the dog, that you possess the dog, because you have never asked the dog what he thinks. He thinks he possesses you. And he has tamed this man. I have heard dogs talking to each other. When it becomes even difficult to love animals, then people start loving things. A house, a car, a bike. And they become too much romantic about these things. I have seen a man, he used to live just in front of my house. He loved his scooter so much that I had seen him almost in a romantic way cleaning his scooter as if he is cleaning his woman. Looking from this side and that, and feeling so happy. And he will never use it because it may get dirty. He will go on his old bike. I told him many times that what are you doing? You have got a beautiful scooter. He said it is, but it is possibility of rains coming. You see, clouds are there. Or even it is too hot and his scooter may lose its shininess. No, I have never seen him using it. He simply cleanses it, cares about it. The scooter is the beloved. This is the degradation of human consciousness. The more attached you become, the more degraded you become. The less the attachment, the higher you rise, soar. And there comes a moment, Patanjali is talking about, when spiritual powers happen to you. Remember, don't get attached to them. Because they are really beautiful. Very fulfilling. You would like to possess them. Many people become interested in yoga, not because of yoga, not because of kevalya, liberation, but only because of vibhutis, siddhis. They study yoga, they go to the masters, they want to do miracles. By being non-attached to even these powers, the seed of bondage is destroyed. This is the last possibility of getting caught into bondage again. If you can cross this, the seed is burnt. Then follows Kaivalya. Then follows liberation. Then you are totally free. Freedom. Absolute freedom. Not attached to anything and full of love, sovereign your love on the whole of existence. A benediction to existence and to yourself, a blessing. But one has to be alert on each step. The mind is cunning. And you may be thinking that yes, when miracles come, I'm not going to be attached to them. Think again. You will find in yourself somewhere a desire lurking that let them come, then we will see. First let them come. Who bothers about Kaivalya? Liberation does not seem to be like a goal. Just to be liberated, free. What is the point in it? People come to me and they say, what we are going to get out of meditation? I say, more meditation. They say, but what is the point? Peace, they say, peace is okay. But what real power we are going to get out of it? Peace doesn't look like a goal. Power. Something that you can do with. Something through which you can prove. I have heard an anecdote, a very beautiful one. Tell me, where do you Catholics get all the money to build cathedrals? Asked a rabbi to his friend. Well, Abbe, you see, we Catholics have a system called confession. Whenever anybody does something wrong, he comes to church, confesses his sin, puts a little in the kitty, and is forgiven. And in this way, we can collect large amounts of cash. Really, what a wonderful system. Maybe we could adopt it for use in our synagogue. But let me go along with you tonight so I could get a far instance of how you work. Well, Abbe, it is strictly forbidden for me as a priest to have you along, but seeing as how you have been such a good friend all these years, I will permit it just this once. That evening, they are seated in the confessional box, the priest in front and Abbe all agog behind. Presently, a man's voice is heard from behind the curtain, Father, I have sinned grievously. What have you done, my son? Last night I consulted with two women. Well, then put £2 in the kitty and your sins will be forgiven. Abbe is very excited. Presently another man's voice is heard, Father, I have sinned grievously. What have you done, my son? Last night I consulted with three women. Well, then put £3 in the kitty and your sins will be forgiven, my son. Abbe can contain himself no longer. What a way to make money! What a wonderful system! Do me a favor, let me do the next one, just to get some practice. Well, Abbe, strictly speaking, it is not permitted. But seeing as how you have been such a good friend all these years, I will permit it just this once. So they exchange places and Abbe sits in front waiting. Presently a woman's voice is heard, Father, I have sinned grievously. Now, what is it that you have done? Last night I consulted with four men. Now, put £5 in the kitty and I will give you a credit for one. Watch out. The mind is very greedy. The ego is nothing but greed. Patanjali wrote this chapter. Many have felt it would have been better if he had not written it. But he was a very scientific mind. He wanted to map out the whole thing that is possible. And he wrote this chapter just to make people aware that these things happen. As far as I am concerned, I think it has been perfectly good that he has included it. Because in ignorance there is more possibility for greed to take possession of you. If you know and you understand the territory and you know where the last attack of the ego is going to come, you can prepare more cautiously. And when it happens, you will not be caught unawares. I am perfectly happy that he included Vibhutipad, this chapter about siddhis and powers. Because even if you are not looking for them, they happen on their own. The more you grow inside, many things start happening on their own. Not that you are seeking or looking for them, they are consequences. Each chakra has its own powers. When you pass through, they become available to you. It is good to be alert and move knowingly where one is going. There should be an avoidance of any attachment or pride to invitations from the superphysical entities in charge of various planes, because this would bring the possibility of the revival of evil. When these powers start happening, you start receiving invitations of higher entities, supraphysical entities. You must have heard or you must have read about Theosophists. Their whole work consisted about these supraphysical entities. They used to call them the masters. There are supraphysical entities who go on communicating with human beings. And whenever you rise high, you become available to them. You become more in tune with them. Many invitations you receive, many messages. That's what Mohammedans call Pagam, the message. And they call Muhammad Pagambar, one who received the message. They don't call him a avatar. They don't call him God reincarnate. They don't call him a Buddha, one who has become enlightened. They don't call him a Jinnah, one who has conquered. They don't call him a Messiah, a Christ. No. They have a very, very perfect scientific terminology for it. They call him the messenger, Pagambar. It means simply that he has risen high and now he is no more functioning. Some other entities, higher entities, have taken possession of him. He has become a medium. And it is so. Muhammad was illiterate. It is almost impossible to think or imagine that he could have given birth to the beautiful poetry of Quran. It is incomparably beautiful. It is one of the greatest songs. And if you can hear somebody singing it, you will be affected by it immediately. Even if you don't understand its meaning, it has tremendous power. The very sound has tremendous power to stir you. Muhammad was illiterate, not knowing how to read, how to write, not knowing anything about literature in the world of letters. Suddenly, meditating on a mountain, he became available. And he heard, "Read. This word, read." He said, "How can I read? The word Quran means read. How can I read? I don't know." Muhammad said, and he became very much bewildered. "Who has said this?" He could not see anybody anywhere. Again the voice came, "Read." It was coming from his own heart. He has become a channel. And of course, he was thinking about his past, and the voice was saying something about his future. The voice was saying that, "I can read, you don't be worried. You just read. I will be reading through you. You recite, I will be reciting through you. You say, I will be saying through you. You just put yourself out of the way." It was so strange, so unexpected, that he had high fever. He became so much puzzled. He came home, fell ill. The wife asked, "What has happened? Just in the morning you were perfectly well, and so much high fever." And he said, "I will tell you one thing. Either I have gone mad, or something has happened from the beyond. I cannot believe that I am capable of anything. But I have heard a voice which says, read, recite. And I don't know what to recite. And not only that, I started reciting. I heard myself saying things I have never thought about. And they were coming in perfect poetry, with meter, rhythm and everything. I cannot believe either I have gone mad or I have been taken possession by somebody. But I am no more the same, your husband." "You run and fetch a physician. I will need treatment. I am going continuously mad and I am still hearing this voice. Recite." And beautiful poetry is descending in me and filling my heart. The wife was his first disciple. She touched his feet. She could see the radiance all around him. It was not fever. It was the first explosion of his aura. He was feeling feverish because it was so hot, so new, and he was disturbed because he was not ready. He was never expecting. He had not planned for it. This would not have happened if he had known about Patanjali. Patanjali has noted everything. He has mapped the whole journey, the inner journey. Then he would have understood this sutra. This sutra was needed. There should be an avoidance of any attachment or pride to invitations from the superphysical entities in charge of various planes, because this would bring the possibility of the revival of evil. But Patanjali says, remember, when you become a vehicle of a higher planes, don't start feeling proud. And don't start feeling yourself the chosen few or the chosen one. Don't start feeling that you have been elected, selected, chosen, and you are special. Otherwise, that will be the cause of your fall. There is a Sufi story. The Mursid of the Mursid of the Mursid was speaking to a group of people. when he was still a young man. In the group was a wide-eyed dervish, dressed simply in brown clothes. This dervish looked continuously at the speaker. He looked with such a knowing stare that the speaker was embarrassed and turned away. At the end of the talk, the dervish approached him and told him that he had been sent to initiate him. "That cannot be so. You see, my father has already arranged for my initiation." "I told you that I have been sent," said the dervish. "No matter. I must obey my father's wish." With this insistence of the young man, the dervish departed. That night the man dreamed that his father was instructing him to be initiated by the dervish. In the morning the dervish came to his room saying that he was there to initiate him. "Do you not remember from day to day? Go, my father is arranging my initiation." The dervish looked at him, smiled with his eyes and said, "Have you already forgotten your dream?" At this the man bowed and was initiated by the dervish. For days afterwards the man put all kinds of spiritual questions regarding life and holy scriptures to the dervish, who simply shrugged them off unanswered. One night the young man was sitting in his room thinking that surely he would get nowhere with this teacher, who seemed so unknowledgeable regarding his questions. As he thought this, the dervish appeared and said in a whisper with great conviction, "I am the answer to your questions." Now these stories look just like stories, mythological, fantasies, allegorical, are at the most symbolic. It is not so. They are factual. If you are ready, immediately from the higher plane, messages and messengers starts coming to you. They have been waiting for long, somebody to become a receptive center. When this happens, don't deny them. When this happens, become vulnerable. One thing, open your heart, trust. And the second thing, don't feel proud. If you can do these two things, God starts functioning through you. You become like a flute, a hollow bamboo. He starts singing through you. But once the pride enters, the song stops. Once you start feeling superior, the song starts faltering. It has happened to many people. They had come in contact with the superior world, the higher world, the supraphysical world, and then they started feeling proud. Sooner or later, that contact was lost again. They became ordinary. But then they become great pretenders, because they cannot accept this, that now the contact is lost. I have seen few people who really came to have miraculous powers, but then they became proud. Then the powers were lost. And then they became just ordinary magicians, because they cannot accept the idea that they cannot do it. They used to do it. It had happened once. This is what has happened to Satya Sai Baba. He had come in contact. The first things that he did were not from him. But now everything is from him. The first things had just happened, but he got proud. Special. A miracle. monger. Now whatsoever he is doing is just pretensions. Now he has to keep his prestige. Now he is even lower than an ordinary magician, because at least the ordinary magician accepts that he is doing just tricks. But this seems logical. Once something you can do and then you cannot do, what to do then? You substitute it by something. You start learning something and doing something. Somehow to manage your status that you have created around you, your image that you have created around you. Whenever something happens to you, and it is going to happen to many, because I have made available many techniques to you, if you go on deeply in them, many things are going to become available to you. The first thing is remain available. The second thing is don't get proud about it. Take it as a matter of fact. Never exhibit it. And if it is forced on you, then ask the forces that you should be made just a shadow, that you should not be in any way aware what is happening through you. Because if you are aware, there is every possibility you may fall. You may start accumulating the ego, I can do this, I can do that. And lower you start slipping. Enough for today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.